Ladies and gentlemen, listen carefully, for in a mere 4 days, once again, the Dowager Countess speaks.
Putting it bluntly, do you think Robert has thrown in the towel prematurely? Good heavens, what am I sitting on?
Swivel chair.
Oh, another modern brainwave?
Not very modern, they were invented by Thomas Jefferson.
Why does every day involve a fight with an American?
I'll fetch a different one.
No. I'm a good sailor.
Oh, the inimitable Maggie Smith there as the stately, snarky Dowager Countess of the Crawley family in PBS's mega hit, Downton Abbey. Downton returns for its 4th season on Sunday.
And now we offer you a synopsis. Dun, 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 dun. First spoiler alert, if unlike us you haven't watched the PBS recap 9 times and don't want to know the show so far, don't listen for the next minute. Okay, it's Edwardian England, early 1900s, time of great change. Downton Abbey is home and castle to the Crawleys and their 3 daughters, none of whom can inherit the estate because they are women, so the whole show revolves around who they will marry.
That's upstairs. Downstairs are the servants, including the saintly Anna and Christ-like Mr. Bates, who are increasingly realizing, hey, why are we stuck downstairs?
Right. Meanwhile, the oldest Crawley daughter, Mary, saves the estate by falling in love with and marrying Matthew, who tragically dies in one of those newfangled cars, but they have a child and, most important, an heir.
Youngest daughter, Sybil, rebels and marries the family's chauffeur, but then, so sadly, she dies in childbirth.
Middle daughter, Edith, becomes a budding journalist. Her parents feel it's certainly the road to ruin. Okay, you are caught up.
It is the highest-rated PBS drama of all time. But Masterpiece executive producer Rebecca Eaton told me, shockingly, that when the Downton script first crossed her desk many years ago, she initially said, no thanks.
No executive in American television recognized its worth or thought it was important to do. Until Downton, there was a kind of an allergy to anything with British accents. So it came around again, and I heard that Maggie Smith had been cast, and she is one of my very favorite actresses. So I scrambled and discovered it was still available and did the deal.
And thank goodness that she did. Rebecca Eaton's recent memoir is Making Masterpiece, and she gave me a brief glimpse behind the scenes of the long-running PBS series.
It cost $2 million an hour to do costume drama, and we only pay a fraction of that when we co-produce with the British partners.
Do you have a great story that people haven't heard of from behind the scenes at Downton?
A great story behind the scenes. So much of what happens behind the scenes is off limits to talk about. There has been the first year, everybody was just making a TV show. It looked like it would be good, but maybe, you know, just a mini series. And the second year, paparazzi were coming over the walls at Highclere Castle, which is where it was, you know, and the actors were stalked right and left. And I love remembering the first time the cast came over, just to see them in this country, to see them, you know, being stopped on the street. Sophie McShera, who plays Daisy, came, and Rob James Collier, who plays the evil Thomas, who is the sweetest, funniest guy, tap dancing down the street, you know, shopping in the village. Just having the time of their lives, that was all in the early days. Now, literally, we have to get them from the airport into the hotel, up to their rooms, because they'll be mobbed.
Register them under fake names,
yes,
I hear.
Yes.
Can you give us a hint about what's going to come next
Absolutely
season?
Absolutely not. No, you do know it is true that Matthew is no longer with us. There's another character who is no longer with us. I won't say who, but you'll discover on January 5th when you see the first episode. The house is in mourning. 6 months after Matthew's death, Mary is not coming out of it, and everyone is very worried about her. And it's a beautiful first episode about this community.
It's interesting because when you write, actually, very interestingly in the book about how you also got a first-hand exposure to the British class system and the life which is so often reflected in, you know, current Masterpiece dramas. Mm-hmm. Like you went to old country houses with the landed gentry.
I did. It was the 60s and the early 70s. Can I remember what I was doing? You know, I was actually working at the BBC. in London when Masterpiece went on the air. I had gone to Vassar College. I was a huge Anglophile bookworm. People were very kind to me when I was there and would invite me to come down for the weekend. And I would go thinking, oh, great, we'll go down for the weekend. And I would go down for the weekend and be served sherry and scotch and champagne. And I remember, I was pretty much drunk the whole time. These beautiful houses. But the Vietnam War was on.
Yeah.
And I had protested the war, even though my brother was in the Navy and he was in Vietnam. And after a couple of glasses of sherry at one of these Sunday lunches, when some rather snooty Englishwoman was sort of demeaning all aspects of America, the dirty hippies and the soldiers who couldn't win, I just let it rip and felt my red, white, and blue origins, and felt very, that was the first time I realized my Anglophilia was definitely a hobby, but wasn't me.
It's interesting because for a generation now, Masterpiece has been the conduit through which Americans experience a certain brand of British culture and British drama. Why do you think that such an appetite in the United States persists for that sort of Edwardian period costume drama?
Well, as I said, I think it was very clear who you were supposed to be then. And, of course, this is slightly romanticized. It was a lot harder to be downstairs than it looks in Downton. But I think what draws people to Downton is the sense of community that they have. The upstairs can't exist without the downstairs without the upstairs. And the way Julian has written it with a tremendous amount of heart, these people are trying to do the right thing. And that's a perfect world. And I think that's often why we watch television.
Rebecca Eaton, she's executive producer of PBS's Masterpiece, talking there at last about Julian Fellowes, writer and creator of Downton Abbey. And Robin, as you know, season 4
really?
Premieres on
what?
Sunday. Rebecca Eaton's new memoir is Making Masterpiece.
And our New Year's resolution is to stream it later online so we're not zombies on Monday morning. But we may have as much luck with that as Jonathan Swift did with his resolutions in 1699.
1699, that's right. As you're making your New Year's resolutions, we're looking at those pledged in the distant past. In 1699, as we said, 32-year-old Jonathan Swift listed 17 goals for the future, including not to be over-severe with young people, but give allowances for their youthful follies and weaknesses.
Here's another. In 1955, 29-year-old Marilyn Monroe said she wanted to take at least one class at university in literature, and she wanted to try to enjoy herself when she could. I'll be miserable enough as it is, she wrote. Mm. In 1972, a 39-year-old Susan Sontag wrote in her diary, "Kindness, kindness. I want to make a New Year's prayer, not a resolution. I'm praying for courage."
And musician Woody Guthrie kept his resolutions. He made a list: learn people better, change socks, write a song a day, and listen to the radio a lot.
I'm just a lonesome traveler, the great historical bum. Highly educated, from history I have come.
He was 30 when he made this list. Other things on it: wash teeth, if any. Don't get lonesome, stay glad. And the last two: make up your mind, wake up and fight. What are your resolutions? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, Happy New Year. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
I was straw boss on the pyramids and the Tower of Babel too. Opened up the ocean, let the migrant children through. I fought a million battles and I never lost a one. That was about the biggest thing a man had ever done.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art with Amy Silman. One Lump or Two, Vivid Abstract Paintings and Drawings, closes January 5th, ICABoston.org.